Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
This is episode 13. I am your host, Mark Herney, and I'm here with my esteemed co-host, as always, Mr. Aaron West.
There's sometimes a buggy.
But we have two drivers for this buggy, and we also have a guest this week. And I should mention Criterion Close Up. We are doing episode 13, the unlucky number, but we are lucky enough to be talking about the Great Mulholland Drive. So very excited for that. The recent Criterion release this week. Normally we have a subtopic where we talk about something else, maybe related to the film or the director, but today we are going to be playing blackjack with a cowboy a little bit, so we're doubling down on Mulholland Drive. We're going to talk about the film and get into, in our second segment, or really our third segment, but second about the films, more about Mulholland Drive, talking about some of the theories. So
it's unraveling the mystery, so if you want to have an inkling of an idea what actually happened, keep listening.
So that's coming up soon. And before we get into that, of course, we have our news. We also wanted to talk or just briefly thank Brian Sauer from Rupert Pupkin Speaks and Criterion Cast Off the Shelf for joining us last week. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, that was a good episode. And for those who didn't hear it, it was The Brood, David Cronenberg, and I recommend you listen to it. One thing that was funny is Brian had some Skype issues. So when he was doing his Criterion Connection, we couldn't hear him. So he kept going for about 5 minutes. Luckily, he kept talking, and it wasn't, and we were, you know, Brian.
Right.
And when I heard the recording, when I was editing, well, I heard some words.
Some colorful ones, Aaron?
Yeah. Well, he didn't actually realize that we couldn't hear him until near the end, and I had to do a little weird edit. But actually, when I first heard it, it was a great story. And I was like, oh, we would have responded to that if we had actually had any idea what you were saying, Brian. But
it's funny.
Yeah, he was a great guest, though.
Yeah, thanks again, Brian. I had a great time with that. And we wanted to just mention we have a change in the podcast schedule. So coming up next week, we are going to be talking about the Krzysztof Kieslowski film, Blind Chance. Originally, we were going to look at the music room, but switching that up. So look forward to that next week.
Yeah, we have a lot of Ray coming with Apu around the corner, so
we'll give him his due for sure. And lastly, in the intro here, we have a winner of the Eclipse set.
The Jean Grimillion, am I saying that right? Hopefully.
Hope so.
we'll find out.
Guillaume will let us know.
Yes, he will. We had a winner, yes, Salty and Mean, I think was the name of the winner. We didn't have a whole lot of entries. I guess, you know, an Eclipse set for an obscure French filmmaker is not exactly grabbing people, but it was we had more than I expected. And so Salty and Mean won, and we will probably do this again at some point, maybe next time with a more popular title.
Right, and next time one of us buys the same title twice, which I'm sure will happen again. So
definitely, yes.
Yeah, it's bound to happen, so. Well, getting into our news, first thing we've got to mention is the newsletter came out this week from Criterion, the monthly newsletter, and we had a wacky drawing in the newsletter.
It was wacky, yeah. Well, it was a picture of angels or cherubs with wings, and they were sitting down and eating some thing that looked like wings.
Wings.
Is that cannibalism? Angel cannibalism? So, actually, I kind of I saw it in passing at work, and I didn't really give it much thought. And my first thought was an angel at my table because you had two angels eating. And then I looked at it closely. There's no table there.
Right.
But I think it's pretty clearly only angels have wings. That's a Howard Hawks movie, and with Cary Grant, it's the first major Rita Hayworth role. So, Criterion's definitely doubling down on Rita Hayworth, and Gene Arthur's in it. It's of course Hawks is a multi genre filmmaker, but this one I think I haven't seen it. Have you guys seen it?
I haven't seen it. I should mention, folks do want to catch up with it before Criterion releases it. I didn't see it's available on streaming, but like we said before, check out your local library if you want. You know, they may have it if you want to check it out.
There was a TCM disc that is now out of print. I believe it's kind of, you might be able to get it somewhere, but it might be available at libraries, and I'm sure there's a DVD out there. So yeah, some more classic Hollywood most likely coming from Criterion. I think that's interesting. So I enjoy all those.
Very cool. And the next, I just wanted to mention, I've as of this week, I know where my daughter is going to be going to school after high school.
Awesome.
Yep. She is going to be going to the Maharishi, I believe, I hope I have that right, University of Management in Fairfield, Iowa, because they, starting in 2016, they have a David Lynch Masters of Arts in Film program. So whether she wants to or not, that's where she's going.
Is Silencio 101 booked?
We could go on and on about that, but yeah, it's
an interesting tie-in.
It looks cool. I mean, it's the first and only consciousness-based film education available. The interesting thing I saw here is it was founded in 1995 by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who was Lynch's transcendental meditation guru. And what's interesting with this to me is that Lynch talks about it in the supplements with Mulholland Drive, how he was meditating. He didn't know how to kind of go along with Mulholland Drive after it was, rejected as a television show by the studio. And, you know, he wasn't sure kind of how to go with it and end it. And it was his meditation that brought this forward. So if you want to make movies like David Lynch, just something crazy and hard to deconstruct, maybe you should check out this class.
Well, if you don't get that job, what kind of job can you get with this?
Good question. I don't know. Something you've got to stay in the surreal realm for this, but it's a great question.
I think psychology or maybe philosophy.
that would make sense.
Yeah.
So anyway, my daughter Maria, you're booked. And next, there was a tweet about Pedro Almodovar.
Pedro Almodovar, is that how you pronounce it? I'm not positive, but
not sure.
Yeah, M.F. Rushmore tweeted he was at a film festival. I believe it was the Chicago Film Festival, and this was not from Criterion themselves. It was from the producers, and they said that Criterion's are on the way for most, if not all, of Almodovar's library. So if people don't know him, well, we had Tie Me Up, Tie Me Down was a release. Was that earlier last year or this year?
Yeah, I think it was last year with the dual format. So
Right. And, of course, he has famous movies like Talk to Her, All About My Mother, Volvere, Bad Education, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And there's a whole bunch. So I think, he seems to be a pretty divisive director, but I think he's a good fit for the collection. So I'd be curious. I haven't seen a lot of his early films, including Breakdown, and I'm a big fan of Talk to Her. Kind of mixed on some of his later work, but
I think some of the DVDs are out of print. I know Talk to Her is still available, but I think All About My Mother's out and out of print. And some of his later stuff, Volvere, The Skin I Live In, Broken Embraces, and of course Tie Me Up are on Blue. So, some of this might be some of the earlier stuff, but hey, we'll see. Looking forward to it.
That's what I'm thinking. And again, this was not Criterion endorsing this, so it's not official yet, but pretty likely.
Excellent. And there was a posting on Criterion this week, The Films That Changed My Life. This was from Hoi Sao Sin. Hope I've got that right.
HHH, is that what I say?
HHH, that's great. And so he talked about a few films. He brought up, I should say this was a conversation during the New York Film Festival with Kent Jones, and Criterion just pulled out a few things where he talked about Breathless, hanging out with Edward Yang, as we all want to do. Naruse's Floating Clouds, and then, of course, Fellini's Amacord. So, and he's back in, he has a film that's out, The Assassin, that played at the New York Film Festival earlier this month. It was also one of the big titles at my local Vermont International Film Festival that I wasn't able to get to, but wanted to check out. So, might want to check out that conversation. He also does mention A Brighter Summer Day that we've been saying. Looks like it's hopefully coming from Edward Yang and Criterion maybe next year. So we'll hope for that. He talks about how Yang says it's about his own personal experience. So good, nice article there from Criterion.
And of course they work together. So you do, and of course Yang has passed. So you kind of wonder maybe possibly he's recording a feature for a disc. Crossing our fingers. And maybe we'll see some Yang coming out, and hopefully some HHH coming out, I think.
Yeah, that'd be great. And lastly, some more repackaging.
Yes, well, we observed that Criterion had stopped selling the jewel cases for a lot of their discs. We found that Sallow and Repo Man are being repackaged and released on January 26th. This is according to DVD List. And it's probably yet another move away from Digipacks. One thing I know is the Repo Man Digipack is the thin one, and those are the ones that I think are the least popular. Whereas, well, some people hate Digipacks, period. Hmm. But Sallow is one of the thicker packages.
I can't help but laugh.
Salo is one of the regular size.
I love that he can't stop laughing. This is great.
This is a blooper reel. Repo Man has that the thin digipack that seems to be not very popular, and those are the ones that Criterion was replacing. Salo is more the normal type, the type that we got with my own private Idaho. So I think it's a pretty good digipack. I'm actually disappointed they're not going to release it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, who would want Salo in a digipack? So
I know. That's true. A lot of people would say, who would want Salo, period.
Oh, right. See what happens.
Yeah, we'll see.
I mean, little sad to see those going away, but anyway. So that's it.
Some people love them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a fan, and I think probably speak for all of us here. We were glad to see Mulholland Drive come in a digipack, and we've got Moonrise Kingdom, and of course the re-release of My Own Private Idaho. So,
and fingers crossed for Apu too. I'm hoping that's a digi.
Excellent. Well, that's it for our news. Keeping a little bit shorter today, and next we're gonna get into Mulholland Drive. Welcome back, everyone. We are here on Criterion Close-Up doing the Jitterbug and talking about Mulholland Drive. I'm here with Aaron West, and we are talking about the recent release of the Criterion Collection film, Spine Number 779, Mulholland Drive from 2001. This is from director David Lynch. Features the actors Naomi Watts, Laura Herring, and Justin Theroux. Wanted to mention, too, that as Trevor is recently posted a review on his site, mooksandgripes.com, so we'll include that in the show notes. Definitely go and check that out. Mulholland Drive, it's categorized, I guess, as a psychological thriller. We'll talk more about, you know, how you might categorize this film further, if you can. Certainly highly acclaimed by many critics. It earned David Lynch the Prix de la Mise en Scène, Best Director Award. I've tried to say that, but at the 2001 Cannes Film Festival, and it also garnered him an Oscar nomination for Best Director. So you'll also see this on the BFI, British Film Institute's Sight and Sound poll. So definitely a well-acclaimed film.
And the AFI poll as well, which is... It's actually a pretty recent film to be included, so that says something about its magnitude.
Yeah, and I've seen this. You guys have probably seen this. Many folks who have done a best of the aughts list. I mean, this tops many of them. Sometimes it's, you know, number two or three, but a very well-regarded film.
People love this film, yeah.
And it actually, I mean, it had its background as potentially as a TV series.
Yeah, some people actually use this as ammunition against it and against the, you know, what Lynch was going for. But yeah, he did shoot the pilot, and I will go into this more in the third segment, into specifics. But he shot a pilot for ABC, and it was supposed to be a spinoff of the Twin Peaks series. And you can kind of see that a little bit in the early shots, just some of the, like, the coffee scene or the man that's saying hire the girl, you know, that's very Twin Peaks-ish. But
right.
Yeah, he was surprised. I think they spent $8 million or something on the pilot. $7-8 million around there. A lot of money. And ABC said, you know what? Pass. No thanks. And you don't say. a little too weird for them, they said. It's actually, there was a lot of time in between, and he went to France and actually got Studio Canal to finance the rest, and I think they spent about another $8 million or so, and we have this feature film. But you definitely do see the TV series, many elements, many actors that, you know, like Robert Forster, pretty well-known actor, only in right. one scene. There's Dan Hedaya, another journeyman actor, only in one scene. So anyway, yeah, I think it's interesting that it was a TV series. I think you can't judge it. I think you have to judge it as a feature.
Right. When it gets back to, you know, what I was mentioning before, how I know in one of the articles I saw, Lynch says that you know, he's happy with how it came out and that maybe it was meant to be a film. And of course, that could be Lynch, you know, defending himself. But
sure,
like I mentioned before, you know, he'd done that meditation, and based on that, there was an extra 18 pages of material that was added. And we'll talk more about what's included, but, you know, the romantic relationship and some of the events after the Blue Box were added. So, and you can kind of, you know, if you wanted to look at it that way, maybe you could see that kind of makes sense, that would be added to kind of tie it up as a film rather than something that goes along as a deep story. I mean, I think folks that are fans of Twin Peaks could see that, you know, Lynch likes to really explore themes over a long period of time if it's a TV show like Twin Peaks, but he can also compact it and into a film like Mulholland Drive that I wonder if it almost makes it harder to deconstruct and, you know, makes it denser and to, you know, really, it doesn't have a specific, you know, plot through point because it's a film and he doesn't have the time to kind of tie up what he wants to say. So.
And you kind of wonder where he would have gone, where he would have taken the TV series. And, you know, they say that we're in a golden age of TV now, but the quality of this film speaks to how, and of course, people would argue that Twin Peaks actually might have kicked that off, you know, a good 20 years ago. But yeah, I think it would have been a different series, but I think it would have been fantastic in its own way. But yeah, it probably would not have the same storyline, and I think it just shows that Lynch is a master at using his own techniques, and you know, we'll talk about the film elements he added. Actually, I have a big thing for the last segment about that. But he was able to make this really what a lot of people would say is a masterpiece.
Absolutely.
You can't do that with Perfect Strangers.
Right. Yep. Absolutely.
Or Friends or something.
the film itself, of course, takes place in Hollywood, and I understand that one of us has a Hollywood
I lived in North Hollywood, which is very close to where these events transpired. Actually, the address is Magnolia and Lancashire for any Hollywoodites. So, but that was in 2000, and I left in 2001, some timing. But when people people came from out of town and they wanted to see the sites, I would always drive them up Laurel Canyon, and I had a convertible. I would drive them up Laurel Canyon and along the Mulholland Drive. It's a beautiful road, and if you're ever in L.A., I recommend you check it out. But as you could tell from the film, it does have, you do see very, very expensive houses. That's where a lot of the stars live. And then if you go down the hill from there, you end up at Sunset Boulevard and Hollywood Boulevard. And so anyway, but what's funny is I move back, and then all of a sudden this movie comes out, Mulholland Drive, and I'm like, oh, I've been there.
Wow.
Is it about my old home?
Well, I have a theory then. So I think, so if you left in 2001, my theory is that you found a little blue box, maybe in an alleyway or someone else, and are you ready to open it on this show, Aaron? Is it now the time?
No, not yet. No, we're going to wait for that. Okay,
but I wait for that.
But I do have a blue box, so just be forewarned.
Nice. So let's get into the movie a little bit. We'll talk about some of the themes and elements, but we wanted to start with Naomi Watts a little bit. She was a character and an actor actress who she. You find this on the supplement a little bit. There's an interview with Naomi Watts and David Lynch, and talking about how really at this point she was at a point where she's a little bit of life informing art, I think, where she was trying. She'd faced a lot of rejection, and she, you know, she had some work, but this was a big potential part for her in this film. Of course, Lynch cast her and Laura Herring, really just based on their photographs. Mm-hmm. And so I'll kick it to you. Just curious what you thought of her performance. And, you know, she plays, you know, multiple characters in this film. What did you think?
Yeah, she's kind of all over the place in this movie. And that's what I love. And and it was almost, you know, when you first watch this movie, that's an experience in itself. But the artifice at the beginning is, you know, I was like, what is this? This looks as fake as can be. But yeah, she does transform, and she does have that, you know, kind of the Nancy Drew mysteries kind of thing. But it's, and then she meets Rita, of course. It's really the audition clip, I think, that really seals her performance. She, you know, she comes into that scene, and I think that's one of my, that's actually probably is one of my favorite scenes of the movie, maybe my favorite. And she comes in with that whole giddy squirrel girl, you know, wowed by Hollywood, really not knowing what to expect. And she, when she enters that scene with the older soap opera actor, you know, at first you're expecting her to be terrible, but she is just phenomenal, how she gets into that character. And, you know, there's also some sensuality, too, that we'll get into. And it's actually kind of a provocative scene in that sense as well. I was tempted to pull a clip for it, but it's so long and it doesn't actually play very well as audio.
Yeah, you need the visual of that for sure.
Yeah, but it's a gorgeous scene, and that part of her performance is great. The third act, you know, there's some things that I'm going to get into later that she does that is, I guess you could say, self-deprecating, humiliating, embarrassing, and it was a very brave performance.
Yeah, absolutely, and she does talk about that scene during the interview too with Lynch, and you know, I certainly see, you could kind of debate how many characters she plays. I think she probably plays a total of three, and very different characters in the film. So I would agree. I think it's a fantastic performance, and she became a actress to watch after this. So you know, it's Naomi Watts, you've done a great job, and you know, we'll see where you go from here. So let's talk a little bit about the you know, the kind of the artifice. So I don't think you can talk about this movie without getting into the, you know, the Hollywood dream part of it. You know, that may be the beginning. We see that mm-hmm. a lot during those scenes with just how wide-eyed the Naomi Watts character is as Betty, and she's, you know, naive. And you know, you talked about the audition scene for, you know, what could be a terrible movie. I mean, it's really, this is where personally a lot of my notes kind of lie. And so I wanted to, but first kick it to you, Aaron. Why don't we play, since I talked about the beginning, let's play the Naomi Watts, the Betty character, talking about her ambitions.
Well, I couldn't afford a place like this in a million years, unless of course I'm discovered and become a movie star. Well, of course, I'd rather be known as a great actress than a movie star. But, you know, sometimes people end up being both. So that is, I guess you'd say, sort of why I came here.
So, yeah, that's not exactly a realistic dream, I'd say. Most people that go to Hollywood from Deep River, Canada, would not find themselves with an audition in within 24 hours. And but, of course, and that's one thing, when I lived in Hollywood, I remember every restaurant, and I hate to be jaded like this, but every restaurant I went to, people were gorgeous. The men and the women, you could tell everybody was an actor, and they were probably all there just to work in the industry. So, but I think Lynch actually has fun with the idea of fame in Hollywood, and I think he likes to tweak the studios a little bit, tweak the system, and we know he definitely lives, I mean, he's very popular, and that affords him a lot of creative license, but he does live kind of within and without the system. But in, you know, early on, we see a lot of exterior shots with the Hollywood sign, and of course Naomi Watts kind of embodies that with her optimism. When she arrives in the airport and is glowing and speaking with these two older folks that talk to her on an airplane, something else that doesn't really happen, not in that way. It's not realistic, you know. She goes, "Oh, that'll be the day," you know, really cheesy things. But that may be the perception of a lot of people, that if I have this talent that many people believe they have, if I just show up, I'm going to make it. So yeah, I think he is poking fun of how artificial Hollywood is, and actually how ruthless it is too, and how how it's not always fair.
Well, it's time to say goodbye, Betty. It's been so nice traveling with you.
Thank you, Irene. I was so excited, nervous. It was sure great to have you to talk to.
Remember, I'll be watching for you on the big screen.
Okay, Irene. Won't that be the day?
Good luck, Betty dear. Take care of yourself and be careful.
I will. Thanks again.
Yeah, I mean, that's really where a lot of what... I think every time you watch this movie, you may pick up different theories and ideas. And I really, from this watching of the film especially, I just think that that's what Lynch is commenting quite a bit on. Like you said, you've got the opening dance number, which to me, it kind of informs the music number two during the film, where he might be talking about the loss of innocence in Hollywood a little bit. Maybe even commenting on the loss of innocence in America, where, you know, you've got the dance number at the beginning, really, of course, taking place during the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we know, we see later in this film a lot of the kind of the dark side, darker side of Hollywood. So I think maybe he's paralleling that. Is also talking about, you know, I think there's some comments on, you know, really who's pulling the strings. I'm sure some of the theories talk about that, because you've got the man behind the glass. There's other people that might be actually, you know, pulling the strings here. So you wonder, you know, if it's really talking about the power structure in Hollywood. And you could even say, you know, talking about Lynch on Hollywood, does he, when he's writing the end of the film, or the film itself, is he talking about the interference of the studio not picking it up as a television show? Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's really the case, because, you know, what he wrote later doesn't inform that as much. I think he's probably, you know, if he's commenting on it, there's more of it in earlier in the film. But I just say too, there's a connection with Criterion about, you know, again from the Hollywood side, how Rita takes the name of Rita from Gilda, mm-hmm. From Rita Hayworth. So, you know, nice little...
Some timing there, huh?
Symmetry there. It's perfect. Yeah. I almost wondered, thinking about it, if Gilda would come out before Mulholland Drive or vice versa. But, you know, we'll be getting Gilda soon.
Also, he takes the movie away from the director, which is probably something that Lynch... Well, he definitely experienced it with Mulholland Drive, too, you know, at least initially, but he's probably fought with people about, you know, say, Blue Velvet. I think he fought about Dune quite a bit, and that's probably why it didn't come out to his vision.
Right. Yeah, he almost he wanted to take his name off it, so... Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, we talked a little bit about the randomness of his films, and, you know, things kind of seem to come out of nowhere. So I think we've got to play what some consider one of the best scenes in the film. He's one of my favorite characters in The Cowboy.
You want to get right down to it, don't you? I should warn people, this is a little bit of a long scene, you know, it's for a podcast, but it's just so engaging. I think it's worth playing.
Howdy.
Howdy to you.
Beautiful evening.
Yeah.
Do you want to thank you for coming all the way up here to see me from that nice hotel downtown?
No problem. What's on your mind?
Well, now, here's a man who wants to get right down to it. Kind of anxious to get to it, are you?
Whatever.
Man's attitude goes some ways, the way his life will be. Is that something you might agree with?
Sure.
Now, did you answer because that's what you thought I wanted to hear? Or did you think about what I said and answer because you truly believe that to be right?
I agree with what you said, truly.
What'd I say?
That a man's attitude determines to a large extent how his life will be.
So since you agree, you must be a person who does not care about the good life.
How's that?
Well, stop for a little second and think about it. Can you do that for me?
Okay, I'm thinking.
No, you're not thinking. You're too busy being a smart aleck to be thinking. Now I want you to think and stop being a smart aleck. Can you try that for me?
Look, where's this going? What do you want me to do?
There's sometimes a buggy. How many drivers does a buggy have?
One.
So let's just say I'm driving this buggy, and if you fix your attitude, you can ride along with me.
As we say, you know, sometimes we say life is stranger than fiction, but I think with David Lynch, we often see just exactly how strange it can be. You know, I mean, you could read that scene with a cowboy as, you know, who is this character? Is he affiliated with the studio executives? Is he affiliated with a gangster? Is he a ghost? You know, whatever it is, you can, you know, look at
any
interpretation.
We have no idea.
Yeah. So, but it doesn't make it any less compelling within that scene. And, you know, that's, I think that's what Lynch does. I mean, he gets into your head and he makes you want to try to figure it out. And, but you're not going to get any answers.
Yeah. And I love how even the conversation, you know, a man's attitude, a man's attitude determines the way a man's life is going to be. I think that's the quote.
Right.
You know, yep. Where in the world did that come from? Before then, it was, you know, a contentious conversation, but not exactly a bonkers conversation. It quickly becomes bonkers, and then, of course, the buggy thing. So
that's part of the mystique of it. And there's the, we've got the, we're not going to play it, but we've got the clip with I'm in love with you seen later in the film.
We're not going to play that?
Are you disappointed, Aaron?
Just a tad. No, I think you are more than I am. I don't think that would play well on a podcast.
No.
You know, about the randomness, and yeah, there's a lot in the early part and a lot, yeah, you can say that was probably due to the pilot and threads that might have been resolved later. But the thing, and you know, there's like the espresso scene, there's, you know, the hitman scene. There's the Billy Ray Cyrus and the pool cleaner scene. There's a lot of things. Each one of them is engaging on their own. And that's, I think, what draws you to this movie. And actually on these little puzzle bits, trying to figure it out, trying to piece everything together, because you just enjoy watching these so much. And we love the cowboy. We don't know what he means, or maybe we do, but we want to know about him.
Yeah.
We want to know his mystery. Maybe we don't want to know about Billy Ray Cyrus and the pool guy. Maybe we got that one. But, you know, I think he's good at making everything engaging.
So I did allude to it a little bit with the line, I'm in love with you. We do have to talk about the sexuality of this film. It's pretty, you know, there's a few scenes in there. And what did you think about Lynch's use of sexuality in the film?
The towel comes off. We don't expect it. And actually, you gave some of the dialogue, but she also does vocalize, I'm in love with you. And, you know, even if it had been developed, you know, in the first love scene, you wouldn't expect actual love to develop that quickly. So I think it is powerful. And I think you can contrast it with the later scenes with, there are really three sexual scenes. I'm sure people don't need me to count them for them, but... So, but the first scene is very touching, and yes, it is very steamy. But the second one is more. You know, there is a narrative. You can make a connection there. It is definitely an evolution of the sexual acts, and of course, the final one is not very pleasant at all. So I think the sex scenes, love scenes, absolutely belong. And you know, and actually, I think it's interesting. A lot of people say that the reason that Lynch doesn't like chapter stops is because a lot of people would fast forward to those sex scenes. I think it's actually more because he doesn't want people to try to unravel the movie. In fact, I think it's kind of frustrating because while I was prepping for the show, if I wanted to watch a certain scene, you know, say in the third act, you know, you have to either fast forward or you really can't. So,
anyway. Yeah, pulling a clip or something. Yeah, and it was nice to see that, you know, Criterion did respect his wishes, and you'll notice no chapter stop and no timeline.
Yep.
On the disc, so the only two menu options are movie and supplement. So they, you know, they do respect the man.
He wants you to watch it the whole time through, but David, I think I've already watched it 10 times. In case he's listening.
Yeah, there should be like a cutoff where if you've seen it this many times, then you get the chapter
right.
Stops, but, so you,
it's like a video game. You reach a certain level, and you
right.
You save the princess, and you get your chapter stops.
You get the bonus level. So. Yeah. So, and we've alluded to a few things with this movie. I mean, how would you classify it? I mean, it's a genre mashup of neo-noir, horror, you could say gangster films, self-reflective. You know, we talked about the Hollywood aspect of it. Is it a satire? So, you know, I really, as I alluded to before, I think it's all of these things. And I think, you know, to me, it brings all of those together to kind of have that that comment on Hollywood. And I would say, you know, as far as the mashup, I mean, there's a scene folks are familiar with. I think it's a bit of a spoiler, and you know, we are talking about spoilers in this film. But if anyone hasn't seen it, the scene with Winkies early in the film, it's just, to me, that was it's one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in a film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really, you talk about building tension, that just entire scene does that. And I really think that's, you know, you take all these different genres and, you know, they say a great film has three great scenes. Well, this film has possibly every scene is great, and it's really pulls you in, and it makes you want to deconstruct the film, but you don't need to. You can just take each scene on its own. That's what I just love about it. So we've got, you know, each one of these scenes come together, and you can kind of, you know, like I said, you can kind of take the film and really think it's about something. You know, if you want to take it from Lynch's perspective, maybe a commentary on Hollywood, or you want to take a look at it as a, you know, as a love story, you can take a certain thread and just watch it a different time each time, and you get a different movie. So, you know, with all of these different genre mashups, why don't I talked about that that scene. Why don't we play the Winkies clip now?
I had a dream about this place.
Oh, boy.
See what I mean?
Okay. So you had a dream about this place. Tell me.
Well, it's the second one I've had, but they're both the same. They start out that I'm in here, but it's not day or night. It's kind of half night, you know? But it looks just like this, except for the light. And I'm scared, like I can't tell you. Of all people, you're standing right over there. By that counter. You're in both dreams. And you're scared. I get even more frightened when I see how afraid you are, and then I realize what it is. There's a man in back of this place. He's the one who's doing it. I can see him through the wall. I can see his face. I hope that I never see that face ever outside of a dream.
Yeah, we do see that the Winky scene really come back into play in this film, and I know we'll talk about theories, but you know, I have theories about what, you know, really what that man's place is. It's interesting that he is actually played by an actress, Bonnie Ahrens. So, and I really, and another thing that really takes me into this film is his use of sound.
Oh yes,
you know, you talked about what the different scenes mean, and you know, I just have to mention, watching this with my wife, we got in towards the end with the scene at Silencio, and I just love that version of crying, and mm-hmm. The story that goes into that audition, how it was just recorded, but you know, Lynch calls it sound and picture flowing together in time, and sound is very important to me, and I think that scene and that song is just kind of jaw-dropping and really pulls you in. And my wife was like, you know, but what does it mean? You know, when we first watched it. And I think when you first watch the movie, you know, you're going to have that kind of reaction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you can get kind of just go along for the ride, you know, she loves Twin Peaks, and we're going to watch Blue Velvet soon. I think that's a little bit easier to kind of get into and deconstruct. So
Por tu amor llorando, por tu amor luego de tu adiós sentí todo.
Also, you mentioned sound, the ambient noise he has is just fantastic. And by the way, a lot of this is playing under us as we're talking, and it'll get more ambient in the third segment. So hopefully that'll give our podcast a little tone.
Yeah. So we do have to wrap up the film. So what would you give for a film rating for Mulholland Drive?
I didn't think much about this. The fact that I've seen this, and I have no idea how many times I've seen it. It's probably at least 10. I saw it 2.5 times this week. So yeah. I want to watch it now. it's so good.
Yep.
It's a 10. It's one of the best films of the, you know, the aughts and you know, I guess the new millennium, I'd say. So
yeah,
not much doubt there for me.
I'm right with you. I mean, I can't think of a moment in this film that I don't like. And if I watched it, you know, 50 times, maybe I could pick it apart, but I can't right now. So it's a 10 film. You know, I think of, we'll talk more about Lynch films later, but I think he's made a masterpiece in each decade from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. And this is his 2000s masterpiece.
Yeah, I agree.
So, with Criterion did release a nice package. We talked about the Digipak. It comes with a 4K transfer. I love the fact, again, that Lynch was involved, as we expected. Also, the director of photography, Peter Deming, does have a 5.1 surround soundtrack that sounds great. And there is there's a Studio Canal release. You know, folks are region free. They could pick that up, the Blu-ray that's been out for a few years. But the supplements are different. So on this one, we have brand new supplements, interviews with Lynch, Deming, Naomi Watts, more of the cast, Baldolamenti, the composer, folks know him, of course, and then production design and casting and some on-set footage and deleted scenes. So some really good stuff here, and of course a booklet as always.
Yeah, the interviews, I particularly liked the Lynch and Watts interview, and they didn't date that, but it looked pretty recent, and they reflect on it's interesting to see them reflecting now, you know, almost 15 years later, on how impactful. Actually, it was most fascinating hearing Watts, because she became a star literally overnight, and I remember when it came out, I didn't know who Naomi Watts was, I kept on hearing things, and then I saw this, and wham, she was a star, and she deserved to be, and she still really is. I did like the composer interview, and the deleted scene I didn't really think added much. You know, I think that was more of a pilot deleted scene. There are probably a lot of those that didn't make the disc. I thought there could have been more, but that said, I appreciated everything, you know, that was brought, and it's hard for me to complain about one of my favorite films of the aughts, but. Yeah,
right, exactly.
There could have been a little more, I think.
Yeah, and I'm happy to. I mean, I did actually buy the Studio Canal, so I'm just going to keep both releases, so I have both the, you know, all the supplements. So. Yeah, I mean, I'd hate to. I would agree. I mean, I like the supplements, and even we always, if there's not a commentary, we complain if there isn't a commentary on there. And I would say, I mean, it's not like Lynch would have to go into the film in depth. He could just talk about the filmmaking, you know, how the scenes were put together. He could talk about certain scenes. He could just, you know, shut up for part of the film and just let us watch it, you know, if he didn't want to comment on it. So, yeah, I'd love to see more on here. But, you know, for an overall Criterion rating, I'm going to give it a 9 because it does have, you know, some great supplements. It's director approved, looks and sounds good. It's really probably what we expected to get for a Mulholland Drive release, and it delivered. So not perfect, but I'll give it a 9.
Yeah, Aaron. We're agreeing too much. 9.
It's a 9.
But I'm going to qualify it by saying it's a 9, and it's probably the 9 that I'm going to revisit the most. It actually could be the Criterion period that I revisit the most, because I just love this film, and I could easily see it another 10 times in my lifetime. So, and now I have a good presentation for it. And it looked fantastic, by the way.
Yeah, it does. So, and, you know, we have the, on the Criterion Blue site, we think about canonizing Criterion films. Is this another Shaq breaking the backboard slam dunk as a canon film, Aaron?
If there was a canon of the canon, this would go in it. So, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. So, and this is one. I mean, we had the clue some months ago with the blue key, and that just started a fervor for people just looking forward to this.
Wasn't that great to see?
Yeah. So. And even before that, I mean, people were thinking that when people wishing for years that Criterion would release some Lynch, and then we got Eraserhead. So this was certainly one that people thought, you know, with something like Blue Velvet already being out on Blu-ray, maybe this would be next, and here it is. So thank you, Criterion.
Yes.
Appreciate it.
And thank you, David Lynch.
So, all right. Well, we'll take another quick break, and we're going to come back into we're not leaving Mulholland Drive, though. We are staying here. We're driving around in a limousine and hoping that no one pulls over and tells us to get out. But we'll come back with some more theories and thoughts on Mulholland Drive.
Hey, Mark, we don't stop here. Oh, wait, we do.
And welcome back, everyone. Unfortunately, we've been driving around in a limo, and we were just hit by a couple of kids driving around drag racing. So we are here disoriented. We don't know who we are, where we are, and we're about to place the blue key in the blue box and go through the rabbit hole. So I'm going to turn it over to Aaron. Aaron has some theories we're going to talk about.
Yes, I am driving this buggy now. And if you have a good attitude, you can ride along with me.
My attitude is great, so let's hit it.
Okay, well, this is called Unraveling the Mystery, and I don't know if you guys remember or if you were part of the online community in 2001. You know, we didn't have Facebook and Twitter, of course, but there was a community, and I was part of a film critic community when it came out, and I remember people went nuts trying to, you know, really from the moment it hit theaters, as we talked about the mystery, people trying to figure it out and piece it together. And I remember actually a friend of mine had a message board, a pretty popular message board that no longer exists, that was just dedicated to people going through, you know, lines, scenes, symbols, and, you know, hundreds, maybe even over, maybe thousand or thousands were participating trying to figure out this movie. And there's a whole bunch of stuff out there still, you know, hundreds of articles. Obviously, David Lynch is really into surrealism, but he also doesn't like to explain things, as you alluded to in the last segment. He likes people to leave it up to their own devices to interpret, and actually he said as much about other films, you know, Inland Empire, Lost Highway, Eraserhead. And I'm going to start this off with a warning from one of the lead actors, Justin Theroux, who has since been married to Jennifer Aniston and is on The Leftovers now, but he's done fine.
Yeah, he is.
So this is a brief interview he did just, that was released just earlier this week. So I'm going to play that here.
I think people who are really trying to break it down and go like, you know, well, no, this is the thing, and the blue key is that, and this is the that. I think you're going to end up frustrating yourself because there is not connective tissue between certain things, and that's okay. And I think that's what David's always saying. I remember when we were doing, when we went to Cannes with it, I remember him kind of sitting us all down and going like, now listen, these fucking reporters are gonna try and tell you, get you to tell them what the story's about. And I don't want you to do that, you know, like it ruins the experience for everyone else, you know? And he's absolutely right. And that goes for every movie kind of, you know, if you sort of tell people what they're gonna get before they get it, it doesn't serve the experience of watching the thing, you know, and it's extra important in David's case because he's just like, you know, he always talks about, you know, when he would go see films, there was no more beautiful moment than when the lights would dim and the red curtains would part. And he's like, I didn't know where I was going. And then I would go there and he's like, and bang, I'm in that experience.
So Justin says that of course, David doesn't want us to analyze his work, David doesn't want us to find answers to his work, and Justin kind of warns not to try it. He says there's no connective tissue, don't try to think about it, just enjoy it, and we're going to pretty much take what he said and throw it out the window. Because I think some of the fun is actually trying to unravel the mystery.
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, it's you know, you can't help but not. I mean, I know, you know, he'll say that you shouldn't deconstruct, David would say, and Justin Theroux, but you should at least take some time with it and then continue to revisit it and come up with your own themes and ideas. And, you know, if you want to shake it up and put it in a box and throw it up and then have it come back down and you try mm-hmm. to piece it together again another time, why not?
Well, what I did this week is I looked at about a couple dozen articles, some fan, some scholarly, and actually the fan ones I think were the more engaging. So I'm just going to kind of talk about some of these and bounce them off you to see what you guys think, if any of these ideas have validity. So,
cool.
You guys ready?
Yeah, it sounds like we're going to get a little room 237 here, so let's hit it.
Yeah, I am turning the blue key now. 1, 2, 3, turn.
Silencio. 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 No hay banda. No hay banda. No hay orquesta. Silencio. 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 Silencio.
Rita.
No hay banda.
Rita. Rita, wake up.
No. No.
It's okay. It's okay.
No, it's not okay.
What's wrong?
Go with me somewhere.
It's 2 o'clock.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning.
Go with me somewhere.
Sure.
So yeah. What you just heard there was the famous Silencio scene. And yes, I know that Silencio scene came before the Blue Key, but that's a nice springboard. But really, both of those are really when things jump off a cliff thematically, the mystery, and that's really when a lot of the clues come in that people try to pick up on the No Hay Banda scene, and of course the final dinner party and so forth. So first I'm going to go back to the pilot. People have analyzed what was on the pilot versus what was on the feature, and again, I don't think this says anything about what his intent, or he did take the elements from the pilot and repurpose them to make a brilliant film. But I think if you want to try to unravel it, you can look at some what he did to change it. So obviously we talked about the sound. He added a lot of ambience. One thing that's notable that he did is you remember the early scene with the Watts coming with Betty coming in and talking to the older couple at the airport.
Sure.
That was in the pilot, but as that scene ends, when you see the two, and that's a very creepy scene, when you see the two older folks driving away laughing, that was...
I love that. When she pats his knee.
Yes.
One of the perfect moments in the film.
It's great. That was not in the pilot. He shot that later. And
okay.
What he was really trying to do is, and I think he was trying to make it fit together, not cohesively, but in a Lynchian way. And of course, we see those older folks come to coming back into the picture later, and that, of course, that was all shot later. So there are a lot of cosmetic changes, a lot of tonal changes, a lot of subtle changes actually. If you watched them back to back, you probably wouldn't pick up on them. But some people have actually watched scene by scene. The pilot actually ended with the mirror scene in the apartment, and that's the. Of course, that is before the sex scene, as we talked. That ABC would not have that. But it ends with Betty telling Rita, "I know what you have to do, but let me do it." Hmm. And so everything after that, for the blue key, the box, there was a blue key in the beginning, but all of that was placed in there for the mystery. So, okay. And of course, the dinner party, the Diane Selwyn stuff. I think when Naomi Watts shot in the pilot, she thought her character was Betty. I think that was the where they were going with that. I don't think Diane Selwyn had really, that duality role had really come into play.
Right, sounds right.
No, I, Banda! There is no band. Il n'est pas d'orchestra. This is all a tape recording. No, I, Banda, and yet we hear a band.
Well, and back in 2001, when people were trying to figure things out, Salon Magazine wrote an article called Everything You Were Afraid to Ask About Mulholland Drive. And this was in October of 2001. So this was pretty fresh. And actually, it's for, you know, I don't know how many times they watched it to unravel this mystery. But they came up with a pretty solid theory that has pretty much, I guess, lasted. It's endured. And in fact, as I talk about some of these theories, there are a lot of constants that will come up that I think are really not up for debate. But the Salon article says that the story is about Diane Selwyn. She had her girlfriend murdered. The beginning of the film, really the first 2 hours, really, up until the key, is a fever dream that is right before she commits suicide. Really, in the moments before she commits suicide, she has this dream. And, of course, everything that... all the elements that we see, the cowboy, you know, you see him at the dinner party. She sees Paul Fisher's character, the Winkies guy with the eyebrows. She sees him at Winkies later. Of course, Diane and Betty are the same person, and that's what this theory says. And then you mentioned the monster in the back of Winkies, who actually, it turns out, and later it turns out to be a homeless person that's just behind Winkies. The monster is the demon that Diane has to deal with after she had her girlfriend, who is Camilla Rhodes, knocked off. So it's really a guilt dream. And again, most of the characters at the dinner party show up at random occasions during the first two-hour dream. So that's, I mean, of course, I can't get into the full theory, but that's the gist. So, all right, well, let me get to... one thing that's interesting about this film, as opposed to others, you know, David Lynch doesn't reveal the mystery, but for a DVD, he came out with David Lynch's 10 clues to unraveling the mystery, unlocking the mystery, I believe is what he called it. So this was in a title sleeve of one of the DVDs. And now David Lynch, of course, he is a very playful, somewhat maliciously playful director, so he's not gonna reveal too much. He wants to leave some to the imagination, but so I'm just gonna talk about a couple of these. There are 10, but the first one is that there are two clues revealed before the credits. He doesn't say which ones, but I think one is the jitterbug contest, and another one is there's the sound of a person falling into a pillow. So that would be Diane. And we see her dead in her apartment later, but that would be her. That's when the dream begins, right after the jitterbug sequence. I guess the jitterbug is probably her memory, a real memory. He also talks about, you know, he says, notice the appearance of the red lampshade. He says the title of the film is significant, the Sylvia North story, which I'm not even going to go into because some of these you could take in a lot of directions.
Sure.
The location of the accident, and I think that is actually important, that they happened at the same place where the hit was supposed to take place, where really the offense took place. And I'll get into that in a moment. He also talked about a lot of the symbols, the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cups. He talks about Club Silencio, which, you know, that again, this no high banda. And what's funny is he fools us, you know. You know, he tells us this is a recording, and then he has that crying song, and you think, oh, wow, what a lovely song. And then
right. That's
fake, too. I love it.
Yeah, she falls down. It's fantastic.
Terrific, yeah. And he talks about the man behind Winkies, and I think that is because he's the homeless man later in the film, and he's the monster earlier in the film. And then also, where is Aunt Ruth? In the dream, she is alive and well, but away, she's...
Making a movie, yeah.
Right. And in reality, we find out at the end that she is dead, and she had left Diane Selwyn major inheritance, which, you know, she used in some ways. So, what do you think, Mark? Do you think that Lynch is giving us something, or do you think he's playing with us?
Oh, I mean, as always, I think he just gives clues to really get our imagination going. I mean, if you watch this movie, you're already trying to piece it together, unless you're just throwing up your hands and saying, I don't get it. But you could look at these clues, and they could send you on, you know, different theories. So I think, you know, to do these theories hold water, I think every one of them can hold water, because they're all a personal theory. And if it resonates with you as to what you thought might be the case, then sure, that's great. But, you know, I've got my own theories. You know, I think of, like, the, you know, the man, the ugly man is, I think that's a nice theory that he's, you know, really the personal demon. I kind of get back to the Hollywood piece where, you know, maybe he's one of the people that's pulling the strings. I mean, he, late in the film, he does have the blue box. Mm-hmm. It seems like a pretty powerful tool. So, you know, you could go with that somewhere. So,
and in the dream, Paul Fisher, who I don't think we know his character's name, but he says, this is the man doing it. Remember?
Exactly.
Yeah. And then Naomi Watts sees him, and whether, you know, that you're not going to get an answer there.
I think
none of these theories have, like, a fail safe, you know, no questions asked theory that would hold up in a courtroom or anything.
Right. I wonder if, you know, if there was, I mean, it's, you know, just these pieces, like, you know, that man comes back. And I also thought of, like, you know, really, how many times do we see the cowboy again?
Right.
You know, you do actually see him, from what I saw, from when I've seen it twice.
You see him three times. Yeah.
Oh, three times total. Yeah. But twice after the first scene.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, let me move on to the next one, because that's going to come up.
Okay.
I pulled about a dozen theories, and I think I only have three left. But one is from Film Crit Hulk.
Yeah, I've seen him on Twitter.
Actually, he does have a gimmick, and he types in all caps, and he has Hulk language, which is funny. But he did write a pretty in-depth analysis, which actually, this is the one that I think holds up. But it's massive. It's actually, I think, around 12,000 words, all in caps. And what's funny is he begins with his Hulk persona, but as he delves into the film, you know, he kind of loses it.
I don't think the Hulk would get through this movie. I think he'd probably watch the first scene. That's it. But
I think the Hulk would walk out at Silencio. Yeah. So, okay, Film Crit Hulk, all these links will be in the show notes. But he refutes the argument that David Lynch is just thinking up stuff. You know, a lot of people do say that Lynch is just making films for the purpose of being weird. And some of the ammunition is because he doesn't share his intention. And in fact, those 10 clues are not very characteristic. He hasn't done anything like that for any of his other movies.
Right.
So a lot of people think that it's just random weirdness. But So he actually wrote this in 2012, you know, not too long ago, and he was not satisfied with the other interpretations. So he went very deep, and I'm not going to go into as deep as he does, but he does talk about Lynch and how Lynch is a very smart man. Now, he graduated from Pennsylvania, and he understands philosophy and psychology, and Film Crit Hulk, I feel weird saying that, but that's what he calls himself. I don't know his real name. He says that Lynch's films delve into the field of semiotics.
I've never heard of it.
All right, well, he defines it as, quote, semiotics dictate that any idea, image, or moment in an artist's work is fair game for said interpretation, as long as the interpreter understands it may not have been intentional on the author's part. Hmm. So that it's actually much deeper than that. You can't put this idea, and read the article. It's a good one if you...
It sounds like Lynch to a T, so...
Yeah. So, yeah, he does like people to try to take it, you know, take on their own interpretation, but there's also... He does put enough fodder in there for them to, you know, to chew on, so to speak. He likes to get... Actually, he loves to get people talking about it. Maybe he's listening to this podcast. If he is, I think he would enjoy the fact that we're tossing around these theories. So, nope. Another thing Film Crit Hulk says is that a lot of Lynch's work is about the duality of good and evil within human beings, and I think that's the case here. He says that Diane, the dream Diane, or Betty, is Diane's best possible self. You know, she comes in, she's likable, she's helpful to Rita, she smiles, and she knocks out that audition. She's a tremendous actress, but she doesn't get the breaks because of powers behind the scenes, whether it's the espresso guy, the cowboy, you know, this is the girl, you know, Camilla, the fake Camilla Rhodes. In contrast, Rita, who is the real Camilla Rhodes, is also her best possible self in Diane's mind. So she's not the famous diva, which we see a little bit. You know, you remember that scene with her on set with Adam in the kissing and making Diane watch?
Yep.
She is innocent. She's actually a bad actress. Remember the rehearsal?
Yeah.
She's deferential, and she loves her Betty, you know, as we... she loves her Betty. So yeah, they're both the idealized versions. So I think this gives a lot of credence to the dream. And then he says that the last 20 minutes is like a map legend. You can use that. It's actually real stuff that's not chronological, but it's stuff that happened, actually, that she reflects upon after her... putting the hit out for her girlfriend. And that's with the blue key. She sees the blue key, so she knows the hit is out. But the real... when we see the third cowboy is at the dinner party, and it's right after she sees... well, she learned about the engagement between Camilla and the director, Adam, and, you know, that made her angry. But it was when she saw Camilla kiss the real Camilla, kiss fake Camilla, the one that was in the audition early, that's when she makes the decision to kill her. And actually, that's the very moment when you see the cowboy walk by, and you see it in her face. And again, Naomi Watts, fantastic performance. And that's also, again, the scene of the crime, and that's where Rita shows up in the first part of the movie. So again, it's 12,000 words. I'm not doing it justice. I do recommend you read it. Another thing, in the dream, only bad things happen to Adam, the director. Whereas in the reality, only good things happen to him. You remember he said, I got the pool, right. She got the pool man. So,
yep.
So yeah, no, he takes the, what they say, the classic theory, and he goes further. And actually, I think, of course, nobody's absolutely right, and a theory can be different for everybody. But personally, I think this theory holds the most weight. And I did read all 12,000 words. So how does that sound to you guys?
Yeah, I could certainly go with that. I mean, I think it's almost a mix of the two. Yeah, I would agree. I think there's some other parts there. You talked about Adam's party. We didn't mention before, but we do see Cheryl Lee. So if you want to talk about, you know, David Lynch bringing people back in, we see Cheryl Lee, or you want to say Laura Palmer. Mm-hmm. I thought I saw her in the background at Adam's party and also at Club Silencio. So, you know, bringing characters back like the cowboy, and just the, you know, the differences there, I think is certainly part of it. And like I said, I think you could kind of see both theories holding weight. I mean,
they kind of do all have the classic theory, as I mentioned. Pretty much all of them agree with varied differences. A different kind of dream. They all have the dream. Some say fever dream. Some say drug induced dream. Some say paranoid dream.
Sure.
If you read them, though, you will see that there are a lot of differences. I think more the Slant article is a pretty long article, but it's not 12,000 words. The Hulk article is very, very long. And then I have a third one that I'm... I did pull some academic ones, and there's a couple psychological ones that I'm actually going to put in the show notes, but I won't actually address them here. But there's a website, and I mentioned my friend had a forum, and this is not the same friend. I don't know this guy. But there's an Alan Shaw put up a website called Mulholland-Drive.net. It's scary. Huh. He has tons of stuff on the, and I'm just gonna, you know, he even has a where to begin, where to start, because there's so much stuff on there, and he's really, really gone deep. So he has his own interpretation, and it's again, the basics are similar. But he goes in a little different ways on some areas. And the basis here, his quote, Mulholland Drive is a story about a woman named Diane Selwyn who is experiencing an extreme mental and emotional breakdown. For reasons that become progressively clear, her life has reached a point of desperate crisis that has driven her into a suicidal depression. The most apparent cause of her deteriorating condition is guilt over a horrible incident she recently set in motion. That we know. That's yeah. Obvious. We know from all the theories. He actually goes deeper, and I can't. He goes so deep, and I think he actually goes too deep. But he said he pulls in the symbolism, and he comes up with a lot of stuff that I think is reaching a little too much. It's easy to reach for a film like this. But he does come up with some stuff in just his main theory that I think are a little different. One of which he says that the older folks, the people in the front, you know, they're almost too good and ideal. But that actually shows that it's kind of a nightmare that, you know, we see that they're a little evil, the drive away in the car. He speculates that this actually could be her parents or grandparents, and that their relationship there's a relationship with them. And of course,
I had the same thought. Sorry, Aaron. That you know, it could be her grandparents' parents. I mean, because they come back so often. They're in the first scene. They're in the car scene. They come back as little people. They're the ones that maybe, you know, drive her to shoot herself in the very end. So yeah, agree.
Yeah, and he actually goes. He goes deep into her personal family history, and also the audition scene with Chuck. Chuck is the other actor that she auditions with. He actually takes the text of that audition, the scene, and he dissects that as a way of her processing her family relationships and the "I hate you, I hate both of us" scene. He thinks that statement is important because that's her way of processing maybe sexual abuse from an older person. Mm. And he actually thinks it could be the parents, that maybe the father or grandparents, whatever they were. And
wow, that could play into the masturbation scene too.
That could, yeah.
You know, that's interesting. That's one of the, when you were talking about all the different dreams, you know, one of the theories I had that just very briefly plays into that is you could say that this entire film up until that point takes place while she's masturbating, so to speak. So
that's actually, you know, that's a theory too.
Yeah,
and this is just the basics. He has like not a 12,000 word, but maybe I'm guessing a couple thousand word essay about it, and then he has supporting materials to back it up, and those go even further into the symbolism, the colors. It's actually interesting reading. Hmm. The one thing about this MulhollandDrive.net place is it links to a lot of other theories, and it and some of them are more not in line with the classic theory, and some are wacky. I'll admit, and who knows? Maybe some are, you know, it does go beyond author intent, so maybe there is some validity to them. I didn't read a lot of the wacky ones, but one theory is that there were two dreams, that both the first 2 hours and the last 20 minutes is a dream. Another theory was that the suicide was a dream, or a fantasy, that she was dreaming of killing herself. And who knows, maybe some of the hitman and such. Another one is that they were drug-induced dreams. So these are all like psychedelic, and you know, with the Lynchian filmic elements, the noise, the surrealism, you could see that somebody on drugs might see some stuff like that, and that none of it's reality.
Yeah, I'm sure people on drugs watch this movie, so, you know, or take drugs to watch this movie. So
I don't want to know what you do in your personal time, Mark. Another one is that this is two dreams of a third person, and I thought that was interesting. There's another one that says the dream was a movie that they watched. That one's a little far-fetched. In fact, these get more far-fetched as they go.
Sure.
Another one was that this was fate and reincarnation. And, you know, I can't summarize these without going into them. I would read them. Another one was that Diane made a deal with the devil.
Hmm.
And going even further, another one is that Diane and Camilla are soul wanderers.
Wow. Like they're in purgatory?
Their souls are wandering. Yeah, you could read it. And then another one is this is parallel universes. What do you think?
Yeah.
That's, of course, logical next step.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Lynch, you could read any one of his movies as parallel universes or, you know, shows, parallel universes, multiple parallel universes. I mean, there's been other TV shows out there, like Lost is one that comes to mind, and Fringe is another one that comes to mind that kind of plays with that trope. So I could see that. I mean, that would be easy to, you know, to kind of play it that way. I do think, I mean, as far as Lynch goes, if he is going to use parallel universes, the most interesting part is when they kind of collide, you know, mm-hmm. When they do come together. And, you know, there's certainly some moments in here that you could point to that. So, you know, if it does hold weight, maybe it's that.
The one portion, the 10-minute sequence between Silencio and crying and so forth, that one is everybody differs. It's tough to explain. But I guess some people think that that's when she's coming to reality, that she's seeing that this reality is being shattered and this is all a tape, and that's when she's about to wake up. And remember, she disappears before Rita goes into the blue box. So,
that's right.
And we actually see Aunt Ruth again after that too, which is completely bonkers. So is there a real answer? And actually, why don't you go ahead, and I think you may have already, but give your answer.
Well, I would have to go with the theory of the moment for me. So, you know, I think every time you watch this movie, it's a different theory. And I frankly, past viewings, I've done the kind of delving into trying to figure out what it is. But my theory this time was a little more hyperbolic, I think. And I know there's some theories about this. I think this is more in line with this being Lynch's persona by Ingmar Bergman.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that's really where I see it. I think it's a piece that has really been written deconstructing cinema for him. And I'll just say that I don't think that's the only theory, but that's just what I took from it this point. You know, I think you could say the film up to Entering the Blue Box, maybe Betty's dream or her initial Hollywood reality or fantasy while she's doing the solo deed, like I said. Mm-hmm. You could say that she is, you know, she's so earnest, you wonder how she can be the same person to deliver that scene. And so, you know, which part's a fantasy, which is the reality. And I, you know, maybe the second part's just a nightmare. But I think, you know, you see like the beginning, the 50s music and dancing. Is David Lynch being nostalgic about, you know, old Hollywood? Mm-hmm. Or is he just peeling away the layers like he does with a blue velvet to show what's underneath the veneer of Hollywood? I think that's probably the biggest through line that I see is that, you know, in his work, in this America, this is what you see. So. And like I said, I think there's, you know, could be some, you know, the loss of innocence. There's certainly a parallel there. And somebody's pulling the strings, whether it's, we said, gangsters. I actually see it more like relating it to the man behind the glass there, mm-hmm. as the, you know, the studio exec who's really making the ultimate decisions. I think kind of, you know, Lynch is playing with that. And maybe even going to, you know, it being... the monster. Maybe that's, you know, he's the one that's, maybe that's the studio exec and that's how he sees them. You know, that's how I really, really saw this. And I should tie it back just briefly with the persona. I mean, you see the mixing of the two personalities,
sure.
You know, in the in the Bergman film. So, you know, you can certainly see those two parallels in this film.
And actually, as far as the demon goes, maybe the demon is actually Hollywood. Maybe that
right.
And when I lived in Hollywood, North Hollywood, I did see lots of homeless people. They're out there, and I would be willing to wager that some of them did go out there thinking that, you know, they had dreams like Betty Schaefer. Betty Schaefer's not a real name.
We'll call her Betty.
Yeah, we'll call her Betty. All right, the last question before we wrap this up. Does it matter if we understand this or not?
No, I don't think it matters, and I don't, you know, think I don't know if Lynch really cares if you think it matters. And like we've been saying, I think he wants us to come up with theories and consider it, but ultimately just go along for the ride. I mean, I think he is a child of or influenced by surrealism. I recently, or just in the last couple of years, discovered Louis Buñuel, and I think he's on the same wavelength that you just have to. You've got to go along with the ride. You have to take these pieces as maybe they're dreams. They're just outside of reality. And, you know, they are unsettling for that. And so, you know, for me, that's why I love directors like David Lynch and Louis Buñuel and the people that can use surreal elements and just make it even seem like a cohesive whole that you want to delve into and try to figure out. And maybe not. Just go along for the ride mm-hmm. and enjoy the scene. So, no, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, well, either way, it's a great movie, and as we've already established. I'd be interested in what theories other people engage with, which ones they think hold the most water, or if they think, you know, we're just grasping at straws. And you mentioned Persona. I do want to mention somebody, Dave Eves, who listens to the show. He tweeted out that a link with Persona images and Sunset Boulevard images. So I think you could see that both of those influences working as well. So I'm curious how other people see the influences from other films. So anyway, reach out to us. And Mark, I'm giving the buggy back to you. You're welcome to steer us out of this thing, and you can tell people where to find us. And
I'll steer us out of this this dream. So you can find the show Criterion Close Up at Criterion CU on Twitter. You can find me at MarkHurne. It's Mark Hurney on Twitter. I've got, and you can find me on Letterboxd at the same place. And of course, I have a new blog that I need to get some links on called Mark Herney's Movie Musings and Podcastings. And also email us at feedback@criterionclosup.com if you have anything to let us know about, any corrections, mispronunciations, anything like that. We'd love to, hear what you think and let us know if you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, what we could do better on the show as we go through this. So, and Aaron, where can folks find you online?
I'm on Twitter at awest505. Of course, my blog is criterionblues.com. You can find the podcast at facebook.com/criterionclosup with no dash. And it's been a pleasure. Hope you guys enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, thanks for joining us again. And any iTunes reviews, we would love them. Love keep them coming. Some ratings there also helps, you know, get additional exposure. And lastly, just want to mention next week again, we'll be talking about the 1987 film from the Polish director Krzysztof Kieślowski, Blind Chance. So we'll look forward to that. And thank you for listening. Silencio.